A key vote may be coming up at the end of the month that could determine the future of public transit in Miami. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Transportation Planning Organization is meeting August 30th to decide if the county should extend Metrorail or invest in a new bus rapid transit system. The TPO had met in July, but they postponed it to later this month, right after the primary election. We'll hear from Miami-Dade Commissioner Esteban Bovo, and we'll take your calls. Plus, Miami-Dade College is launching a new center. They want to train future generations of cybersecurity specialists. We'll learn more about the program and the new cybersecurity center that'll give students a real-world feel. And then we'll learn more about the Umbrella Sky Art Project in Coral Gables. It has thousands of people flocking for its social media pics. What did it cost, and what happens when it comes down? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, later this month, Miami-Dade County leaders are coming together to once again discuss the future of public transit. It's the Transportation Planning Organization. They may vote on whether the county is going to move forward with plans on a bus rapid transit system or expansion of Metrorail. Well, on this program, we've heard from proponents for more rail, like State Representative Keone McGee.
There was a promise that was delivered in 2002. The county approached the people in Miami-Dade County and said this: if you decide to voluntarily tax yourself at a half cent, we would deliver to you in the north, the south, we would deliver to you rail. We would connect this entire county. We would make the roads better. We would produce a better system, a coordinated system. I can honestly tell you, since 2002, we've gone through at least three presidents, three mayors, probably countless governors, and yet they have only delivered 3 miles of the 88 miles.
And we've also heard proponents of the BRT, this bus rapid transit system, like Mayor Carlos Jimenez.
If, in fact, we put rail all the way down to South Dade, they will be taking and gobbling up something like 73% of all the money that's available for transit in the next 40 years. That, to me, is irresponsible.
And we've heard from you, like Omari Hardy. He spoke to us on Twitter, and he said it's obvious that what Miami needs is a transit solution that doesn't involve cars, buses, any vehicle that travels along the county's choked-up roadways. Rail will help catapult Miami into a league with other first-rate American cities. BRT will be an embarrassment. All right, so we want to hear from you some more. We want to know what you're thinking. You've been hearing the arguments for both sides. Joining us now in studio is Chairman Esteban Bovo, who has a unique take on the future of public transit in Miami-Dade County. Mr. Bovo was also recently named the chair of the South Florida Regional Transportation Authority, which oversees Tri-Rail. Chairman Bovo, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Luis. It's a pleasure to be here.
I got a lot going on here. There's a lot to talk about. I do want to mention, though, real quickly, that we still want to hear more comments. We want to know from you if you've been convinced one way or the other. How do you feel about this? But also, Chairman Bovo's here. What questions do you have for him? 800-743-9576. Again, 800-743-9576. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter, WLRN Sundial. We'd like to hear your thoughts. Okay, so Chairman Bovo, you know all the arguments. You've heard it all. More rail, this new bus rapid transit system. What do you think is going to happen?
Good question. And it really comes up to the TPO to make a decision. I'm a rail guy, and I think I want to put that out there first and foremost. I've been a proponent of rail now for a long time, and I feel that the only way for us to deliver on the promise that was made, as referenced by the representative, is to show the residents of Miami-Dade County that we're serious and about expanding our system. But I'm also a realist in that 40 years of poor planning, Lewis, is now come back to haunt Miami-Dade County. Elected officials after elected officials would approve developments over and over again that never required any kind of thought process or vision that would connect these communities via some sort of mode of public transportation. When we talk about the South Corridor, and I think it's important to mention that we own the corridor, and that's one of the key pluses here. But that corridor already had rail laid on it, and it was somebody's vision way before my time, sometime in the 90s perhaps, late 80s, to tear up all the rail that was on there and pave it. Imagine if we would have had the rail there now, this conversation probably would be totally different, right? What I think the TBO is going to be asked to do the way I'd like to see us look at this conversation is that, is an initial step on BRT only that initial step that'll get us to rail long term? And I think that's the way we need to look at it. You cannot have you can't have rail without the proper ridership numbers. And right now, that busway is looking at somewhere about 14,000 riders per day. We need to get somewhere around 35 to 40,000 riders per day in order to justify the investment in rail.
All right, now we're talking about ridership and how to bring ridership back up. But let's go back to that meeting back in July, because we were expecting maybe a vote then. It got pushed to the end of August. What happened? Why did it get pushed off? By the way, it got pushed off to August 30th, 2 days after election.
There was a motion made by the mayor of Homestead, Mayor Porter, to approve the administration's recommendation on BRT, in other words, the small starts application. It was seconded by the mayor of North Miami with a proviso that if the ridership along the South Corridor hit 35,000 riders per day sustained, that application then morphs into a rail application. That was the motion that was made. Upon making that motion, Commissioner Jordan from the north end of the district, who had spoken earlier not so much about the South Corridor, but about what needed to be done in the North Corridor, completely separate conversation that was needed on that day, makes a motion immediately to defer the item. She gets a second, and I forget who the person that seconded the motion, but what in our rules, basically, that motion to defer takes precedence. We had to address it first. I asked the attorney for clarification because I had already accepted the motion by Mayor Porter and the amendment by the mayor of North Miami. But the attorneys tell us you need to take the motion to defer. Now we vote on the motion to defer. The majority of the board members there basically voted to defer the item. I believe it was Commissioner Jordan. It may have been a group asking, when do we do this item? And then they settled on the 30th.
And so it just also to clarify, this again was to discuss the South Corridor.
South Corridor.
That was the, okay. So when we get to August 30th, do we expect more public conversation, or is it now just straight to a vote?
Public testimony has now been done on this issue. We still have in the queue commissioners and board members that want to speak. We still have about six or seven members that want to speak. We have a photocopy of the list that we were keeping. So we're going to pick up the meeting on the 30th after we do our formalities where we left off.
Could the vote be delayed again?
It would be hard pressed. If there is another motion to defer, I think at that point those that want to see something happen would probably override the deferral. I grant you that there was probably some that would prefer to deal with this after the election cycle. There are some that picked the 30th because, quite honestly, we're off during the month of August. Most government organizations, local government organizations, take off the month of August. So we'll pick this thing up again at the end of the month. I don't see another deferral. I see one way or another, it has to be a yay or nay vote.
There are five county supervisors facing a vote in the August primary.
Yes.
Looking at the ballot. I mean, is there a concern that, you know, were we waiting to see if maybe some faces would change?
I don't think so, to be perfectly honest with you.
Do you think if it changes, if a lot changes after the vote, that this argument goes a different way?
There may be one or two that could maybe sway their way. I firmly believe the votes were there to pass this item on that day that we met. But like I said, I think some probably erred on the side of being cautious, not wanting to tackle, you know, thorny issues before an election. I get it. I guess I understand it. But I've always maintained that we're elected to make these decisions. And I would expect, number one, that all the members of the TPO are there, sitting in their seats, getting ready to vote on this item. We have had many occasions where TPO members, you know, aren't there, don't show up for meetings. And this, to me, is probably the first critical step toward what could be the long-term vision of transit in Miami-Dade County.
And Mayor Carlos Jimenez was on the program last week. He believes the votes are there for this BRT system. You think that's the case?
I could only go based on, I can't talk to my colleagues, so I can only base on the rhetoric that was being said at that moment. And I think the votes are there. I think there's enough desire to start moving this conversation from speculation. And there's a realization. And again, I said earlier, I'm a rail guy. But in order for us to be able to pay for rail, it's going to take us another 10 or 15 years.
This goes back to what Representative McGee was talking about. He goes back to 2002, that half-cent tax. And it's like the promise was made. The money was supposed to be there. Yes, you guys weren't elected. I mean, you're not the elected officials from back then who made those promises.
Right.
But so what happened? What happened with that money? What happened with the promise?
A couple of things happened with the promise. First of all, it was overpromised. We have to go back into the archives to remember that there was two failed full penny campaigns before settling on the half penny. And I think a lot of folks and a lot of things were said during that half penny campaign that talked about Metro Rail going all over the county, talked about buses, talked about sharing resources with cities throughout the county. But somewhere, and we're doing all this analysis work now during our break, around 2006, 2007, money started being commingled between the half penny and the regular budget in transit. And we've seen this before in government. We saw this with the Florida lottery. We, the voters, approved a Florida lottery, hoping that it would help education, but it was supplanting the budget of education. Same thing happened here with the PTP money. Money was being buried back into the budget, and in essence, you were now using that money that was expected for expansion for operation.
So what do you do? How do you, I mean, you, this isn't something interesting you had mentioned to me before in another conversation, is that how does government keep its promise if over time you're not keeping your promise? Money's getting shifted around or as you just said, it overpromised. You promise more than you can give. So now it's on you.
Yeah, and it's frustrating because now the ones that are there now have to fulfill promises that, for the most part, none of us made. There are members, though, on the TPO, members of the Board of County Commission, that were around when this promise was being made, that were facilitators while this promise was being made, and perhaps are the same ones now that feel the pressure to deliver rail when they haven't delivered since then.
So is the mayor right? There's no money for rail. Not the rail expansion people expect. Not yet.
Lewis, I could tell you categorically, I'll say it for the third time, I'm a rail guy. The only way we're going to see rail develop itself over the next 3 or 4 years, if there's an intervention by a private entity. And that intervention will only happen, if it's a real estate play for those private entities. If they look at a corridor and they see the value of real estate and the potential of real estate, then the connectivity of rail through all those corridors is just a functionality of connecting all that real estate play.
We're speaking with Chairman of the Miami-Dade County Commission, Esteban Bova. Bova has also recently became the chair of the South Florida Regional Transit Authority. That's the organization that oversees Tri-Rail. We're discussing the potential for future rail or bus expansion in the county. We want your questions. 800-743-9576. Let's start with, I want to go to Bob in Coconut Grove. Bob, thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. I want to suggest that the listeners and the gentleman speaking refer to a book by Edwin Black. It's called Internal Combustion. And in one of the chapters, it addresses the transfer from the trolley systems in most of America to buses. And it was all about, in my understanding, selling tires. And if you amortize the tires that you're going to crunch the numbers on for buses on these roadways, these crowded, clogged, I live in Coconut Grove, the nearest parking is in Oklahoma, but the crowded the crowded roads that these buses are going to occupy are a no-brainer as referred to rails. If you start thinking of rail wheels alone as a 30-year investment, they're going to last that long. Do the math on tires and come back to me. Thank you very much.
Bob, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Before I go to the next call, I mean, so has the incentive always been on buses, really? I mean, is you know, and obviously he's saying that that's not the way to go.
Well, part of the dilemma that we have when we want to talk about rail and expansion of rail is that you need the right of way. And just purchasing the right of way could be a very thorny and quite honestly, a very politically charged issue. And I'll give you an example. When we talk about the North Corridor and we talk about taking from the MLK station in Liberty City out up 27 to the stadium, the no-brainer would say, well, you run it down the center. But in that community, there is history where I-95, where, you know, roads that cut through those communities divided those communities, and they're very sensitive to it. So if you go rail down the middle of that community, up 27th, there's a narrative that you're dividing the community, and that could lead to economic downturn and whatnot. These are real conversations that happen in the North.
All right, let me go to Glenn, who's been waiting in Fort Lauderdale. Glenn, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
Yes. I've been writing letters to the current mayor, past mayor, about this issue for years, almost 20 years, and I've came with some logical solutions. One is, if you have private industry assist, for example, if the train actually went up to the stadium and you get a commitment from the Miami Dolphins or the Hard Rock Casino, because I'm sure they would love to see a train stop at that stadium. You get a commitment from some of the colleges and universities. Even if you had the train go to Broward County, to the International Airport, and you get a commitment from them to have a station there, or the Broward Central Campus, and other colleges and universities, other business associations, you would get contributions which will cut the cost from the taxpayer. Second, I believe that we have the wrong people in jail. These politicians have been promising and have been taking money for one thing and using it for something else. They need to be put in jail. We got the wrong people in jail.
Well, and we got
It's no accident that they keep talking about private industry taking over, because I think that was their plan from the beginning.
Well, we heard, Glenn, I apologize, only because of time. I got to cut you off there. But, I mean, I understand what you're saying. You know, but you said something interesting, Glenn. You talk about private, public-private partnerships. I brought this up with the mayor, and he kind of laughed it off a little bit. And obviously, Representative McGee thinks this is the way to go. But where are we missing out here? I mean, is it possible to hook up with private industry on the rail to help in cost and time of construction, or is that not an option?
Well, I think it's an option. And I want to say first, Glenn, you nailed a couple of things that I think are critical when we talk about the North. Miami-Dade College, the stadium, can be contributors to building station, could be contributors to developing the infrastructure we need to be able to pour money into those corridors. We've passed legislation that I think help with our TIF legislation, creating RTZs that give the county the ability to look at zoning, to look at land use along these corridors. The key with the private-public partnership is this, is that the private venture could step forward today with their capital, but they're going to expect a return on their investment. Private industry does not get into business for the sake of giving things away. Their model would be, we invest today, but we're going to reap those benefits in the long run. Our performance show that where we start running into real money is 30, 40 years out. The question is, can you lure the private venture today and that private venture expect to reap their rewards 30 years out?
Let's come back over to this idea of ridership. So, you know, right now, Miami really, looking at data, this was published in the Miami Herald, federal data that reliability with our bus system is one of the worst.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of ghost buses that don't show up on time or don't show up at all, and a lot of breakdowns. I know there's conversation about upgrading the buses and even moving into electric buses, but, I mean, how do you increase ridership if we can't keep that bus system, if we can't keep the fleet we have upgraded, and we're even cutting back because ridership's been going down for the last 3 years?
A lot of components that now affect this. Uber and Lyft has cut deeply into the numbers of riders. There is a rider that used to use our system, but is now willing to pay a little bit more to go door to door. That's a decision that they've made, and it's hard for us to capture what that number is, but it does exist. The three trolley systems in the city of Miami, Miami Beach, Doral, Coral Gables, have been gangbusters. Miami Gardens, all are now providing a service, which quite honestly, a rider now has the decision, do I ride free on a local trolley or do I take a county bus?
Does that mean that we have to look at lowering fares or even offering free service?
I believe that you now are obligated to look at your entire system, and perhaps there are corridors that we feed now that are better left to be served by a local municipality.
I have to end on this just real quickly. The August 30th meeting, what do you think is going to happen?
I think the TPO will approve a small starts application that will allow us to get federal dollars to build two critical ingredients to ultimately bring rail, stations and crossing guards along all of US 1. I think it's the right step for us to do, and I think that's what the TPO will do.
And we're going to keep an eye on that meeting. We'll follow it. Again, Miami-Dade County Commissioner Esteban Bovo, chairman of the commission, joining us, talking about the future of transit. What's it going to be in Miami? Mr. Bovo, thanks so much, man.
Thank you for having me.
All right, still to come on the program, Miami-Dade College is starting a new program to train the future workers in cybersecurity. That's coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, as primary voting approaches later this month, elections officials remain concerned about the cyber threats posed to our voting systems. Cybersecurity is consistently threatened across government institutions, private companies, and nonprofits. And with the advent of home devices and biotech, our personal data is consistently in jeopardy. The Cybersecurity Center of the Americas at Miami-Dade College launches this fall with a focus on training the next generation of security professionals. The school is a state-of-the-art control room that is actually going to simulate a real-world security operations center. Jorge Ortega is the director of the center and comes from years working at Intel and McAfee Securities, and he joins us in studio to discuss the cybersecurity threats on the horizon and how these students are going to be prepared for that future. Mr. Ortega, thanks so much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So take us inside the Cybersecurity Center. What does it look like? What are the tools that students are going to be using? What's inside?
Absolutely. So the Cybersecurity Center, what we wanted to make sure was that we were giving students and professionals alike, because this is a training center that could be used both by students and working professionals in the IT industry, is the opportunity to get what we consider to be advanced high-level security training. What that means is we're looking to give them the critical hands-on skills that you really need to be successful in today's industry. So when you look at the cybersecurity landscape in general, you're seeing a lot of open positions. So you're seeing almost 300,000 open positions throughout the country, 12,000 in the state of Florida alone. And what's happening is organizations, and it could be private sector, public sector, it could be anything from law enforcement to government to private industry, is having trouble finding qualified cybersecurity experts. And a big reason for that is because of the lack of hands-on skills. And so what we're doing at this center is, because of the unique training platform and the facility that we're having, we're going to be giving them those type of hands-on skills that will allow them to act.
And that, so there's something interesting you brought up we're going to get to in a moment, which is the lack of having enough skilled workers out there. But let's go back to this center and how you're going to give them that training, because I had mentioned earlier that you have this control center.
Yep.
That basically is this real-world experience they're going to have, where they're going to have exercises and they're going to have to, an emergency comes down, something happens, all of a sudden all the systems are at risk and now they got to figure it out. But take us into that room. What does it look like? What's going on?
Exactly. So the room was created to mimic a security operations center or network operations center, which is, most people are familiar with that from maybe ads or the movies or TV, where you see a lot of the war room type scenarios. In addition to having that facility, which will allow students and professionals to feel the true sense of being under attack in the same type of environment that would happen, we also have a training platform. We're only the third institution in the entire country to have this training platform, the only one in Florida to have this exact type of training platform. So it's a really unique opportunity. And what this training platform does, which differentiates from a lot of training, is that it simulates an actual network that has the size and scope that most professionals will find out in the industry, with all the different tools and servers and traffic that you will have on a true corporate environment.
And that platform you're talking about, we're talking about, like, it's a way to train people in that real world experience. So let's imagine there's an attack, and this is, you're going to set up a simulation where what a corporation is being attacked or something like that.
Correct. So this network will emulate, as I said, what a corporation will have, and then we will introduce real world malware into that network. We have different attack scenarios, so anywhere from ransomware, man in the middle, SQL injection. These type of real life attacks will be introduced to the network, and the trainees will be forced to detect and neutralize and remediate the situation. And again, it's a little bit different from traditional training, which is more based on lectures and readings and that type of activity. Here, you're really forced to act. And again, that's really what we're aiming to, because when you get out in industry and you get out into the organizational network, you need to understand how to respond to these cyber threats, especially today where they're becoming more and more complex and advanced.
We talk about cyber attacks, on a regular basis. It's just part of life. Yeah. Ransomware attacks and malware attacks. Help us understand what the differences are.
So there's a lot of different types. Malware is essentially malicious software. So there's a lot of different brands of that. And ransomware is one of those. Ransomware has been very popular lately. It's been in the news a lot. And essentially what it does is it locks up and encrypts your files or your network or parts of it. And then it forces you with a time limit to pay a ransom to unlock those files, to receive those keys. Otherwise, those files will be lost forever. So that's a situation where there's clearly a financial motive. The person that is trying to launch that attack is looking to be paid for that attack.
Are the ransomwares typically done against individuals? I've heard about some of these where somebody says they've got all your passwords. Mm-hmm. And if you don't pay this ransom, they're going to basically destroy your accounts.
Yes.
And stuff. But so is it mostly towards individuals, or even ransomware could be attacks on larger systems and corporations or governments?
We've seen it in both. So you see it to private individuals. Unfortunately, ransomware is not very complex in order of creating it and deploying it. But we've seen it both. Individual attacks, and we've seen it large scale. You just saw the city of Atlanta was attacked with a ransomware attack recently, and it shut down a lot of their critical infrastructure, and it took them a long time and a lot of money to get everything back up to speed. So these ransomware attacks are happening more and more with more frequency, and what you end up seeing is that these ransomwares are able, and like all malware, they're able to infiltrate the networks, because now there's no longer what we used to call a perimeter, where you would have the network very controlled. Now what you see is everybody using their own bring your own device, a lot of telecommuting, so remote workers, people using their own laptops, their own smartphones, their own tablets. And so what's that's doing is that's giving the security department, the IT department, a much more difficult challenge to be able to control what their users are doing, where their users are clicking malicious links or downloading malicious attachments or whatnot. And then once that happens, and that again, that's why we're focusing so much on understanding how to respond to these attacks, because once it happens, you have to act. And so that's what we're trying to create.
Are a lot of the attacks still based on the simple mistakes that we make as individuals when we open an email or go into a link we shouldn't go into, or are they finding other ways to get in?
No, I'd say that the bulk of the attacks are still very much what we would call rudimentary, user error. And that's why, we also propose a lot of security awareness training and different exercises to get your security users. And we're talking about everybody from your frontline admins all the way up to your C-level executives to understand the repercussions of the actions they take, to be very cautious of what they do. Because a lot of what you see today is not a complex breach, but rather user intervention or even social engineering, which is almost nothing to do with the technical side, where you just someone puts their password and writes it on a Post-it note and leaves it by their desk, and now you have this person's credentials
sometimes you have help desk people at the help desk give information out.
Absolutely, someone will call, and especially today with social media, everyone knows everybody's title, where they work, who their team is, so they can call a help desk and say, I am this person and I forgot my credentials, can you please give them to me? And a lot of times they'll be able to get it that way as well. So in that case, it's even more complex, because then the person's logging into the network with actual credentials, but to do malicious activity. And so it's a complex issue, and not one that's easy to solve, but one that needs to have a lot of focus.
I'm talking with Jorge Ortega. He's the new director of Miami-Dade College's Cybersecurity School of the Americas. And we're talking about the greatest cybersecurity threats facing governments, businesses, nonprofits, individuals as well. And what this program is going to do in preparing, I guess, those future cyber warriors as they go out into the world. You come from Intel and McAfee. I had a slip of the tongue early. It's McAfee Securities, working in the business side of their cybersecurity sector. How's that experience brought in to inform the school on what they should be teaching people?
So one of the great advantages of my experience is that I saw how too many times the security profile was to have products. So a lot of times, you know, there's a proliferation of security products out there. The startup world is rife with cybersecurity products. And what happens is you can't just rely on products. The old adage was just make sure you layer a lot of products together and cover everything from your endpoint to your network and your mobile. But I feel that as time has passed, we've seen that training and having capable security analysts and even up to the C-level executives to understand incident response and to understand the dynamics of having a breach and what it entails is another level. So you don't want to rely just on product accumulation, and right. And you want to really focus as well on training and having security experts that can know how to manage those products.
I want to go to this idea of prevention or being proactive, but let's talk about Equifax. That was the big data breach. Do we know if there was a way that could have been prevented?
So from my understanding is it was essentially a server that had not been patched. And so that's something that's very... again, something that is considered standard practice to make sure you always have all the security updates. But in this case, they had not done that on some of their servers. And that brings up another interesting point is that companies having very complex networks sometimes are very slow to be able to improve their security profile because they're scared to upset the balance of their network. So if you introduce new security updates, it may all of a sudden create a havoc that you weren't expecting. So you have to go do a lot of testing to ensure that your security products and your network can take these updates. And so in this case, that had not been done yet, and that led to a vulnerability. And what happens is sometimes you'll see when a vulnerability becomes known, it could be exploited within minutes.
Is it about cybersecurity? Is it about constantly trying to keep up with what is going on, again, from all these attacks? Is it really just trying to keep up with the attacks? And whether it's my independent computer, my individual computer, or the company system, we have to constantly get these updates and upgrades to keep up with what's happening. I mean, is that really what we're dealing with? Is that just the way it's going to be?
I think that's the way it is now. I don't think that's the way it always has to be. You're seeing a lot of the industry going more to machine learning, artificial intelligence. It's making its way into cybersecurity so that it doesn't rely so much on the constant updating, but yet you can have a tool that will understand behavior analytics and be able to control flow of data. But that's still, it's still a slow moving process. So right now there is this constant focus on having the latest updates, having the latest patches, having constant updating.
Are criminals, are they ahead in this game? Is it a cat and mouse chase? Are we ahead of them? They're just always annoying us, or are they ahead of us and we're chasing them to keep our system safe? I mean, what's going on?
Yeah, I think they have traditionally been very much in the forefront of technology. And so it's very difficult because, as I mentioned before, with the fact that our lives become more and more digital, right? Now you're having biometrics, autonomous vehicles, the Internet of Things, smart homes, etc. So our lives become ever more digital. That gives the criminals ever more opportunity to get in through different methods. Again, whether it be just social engineering or a very complex SQL injection type attack, it just the fact that we continue to have our lives be more and more digital creates more and more opportunity. And it's like anything. You're the criminals that are motivated by any, it could be financially, it could be social or political causes, whatever the case may be, they always seem to be able to find a way to get in.
There is concern that once students are taught these cybersecurity skills, that they could use them maliciously. I mean, is there concern that you might actually be creating the next generation of hackers? I don't even know if that's a word people like to use anymore, but you know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely. You know, one of the good things about what we're doing is a lot of cybersecurity training does focus on what's called red team, which is really much the offensive side of cybersecurity, which is how you hack and how you get into these systems and what you can do once you're in there. For our center, we're really focusing on the blue team aspect of it, which is the defense team. So in our situation, we're not teaching offensive strategies. What we're doing is we're saying you have a network and you're going to be attacked by these offensive strategies, so you have to learn how to defend. But students, I mean, again, with today's technology, they can go online. It's not that difficult to learn these techniques. So anyone that is interested and wants to learn about how to do these different methods, there's ways to find it.
Let's finish up with this, because you had said earlier that there's a lack of workers out there, mm-hmm. the skilled workers necessary. Where are the opportunities for students once they finish the training? I mean, are there a lot of opportunities here in South Florida, here in Miami, or are they going to have to take those Silicon Valley or go to New York or something like that? Where's the demand?
So right now, you know, we're definitely seeing Miami grow as more of a hub for technology. We're seeing some really some large-scale technology players setting up shop here in South Florida. And so one of the plans that we have with the Cybersecurity Center of the Americas is not only to develop this talent, but to keep it and to let it develop within this ecosystem. There's still a lot of room to go. But in terms of cybersecurity, the beauty of it is that there's so many industries and so many organizations that need that. You know, traditionally what you had was you had an IT person and they also did the security side, but they weren't experts. That dynamic is starting to change a lot. And so what you're seeing is organizations from small, medium businesses are having to get security experts on staff.
Real quickly, what are you going to tell the students? Because the program's mm-hmm. starting this fall. What are you going to tell the students about, you know, where those opportunities are and where, you know, what's ahead for them?
So what we're doing is we're right now we're meeting with a lot of different industry leaders, all these different organizations, again, public, private sector, and just really making a lot of the contacts that we want to have, so that we let them know that many of them have already come up to us and said, as soon as you start producing these cybersecurity experts, we want to know about it because we have the need. And so that's what we're starting to do, and we're starting to really sort of generate that talent and generate those connections. And the other thing we want the Cybersecurity Center of the Americas to be is a hub to allow industry and students to commingle and get to know each other and network in that fashion as well.
Jorge Ortega, again, the new director of the Miami-Dade College Cybersecurity School of the Americas, that's launching this fall, preparing those cyber warriors for the future. Jorge, thanks so much, man. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we'll have more information, by the way, on our Facebook, WLRN Sundial, later today. Well, coming up, have you gotten your Instagram photo at the Umbrella Sky Project yet? It's only going to be up for a little while. It's coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. All right, so colorful umbrellas may have been blowing up your social media feeds. I know, if you haven't seen it, you have friends on Facebook or Instagram who've been posting it up. The Coral Gables Umbrella Sky Project went up in early July. The street of Giralda Plaza has become Miami's newest tourist attraction. The project is by a creative agency based in Portugal called Sistafera. Before the art installation, ongoing construction had a negative effect on the businesses in that plaza. So city officials say the umbrellas have really been a game changer. They brought in new customers and a downpour in profits. But to what extent has the Umbrella Project improved business in the area? And will the future of those businesses still be good when those umbrellas come down? They're not going to be there forever. Joining us now in studio to talk about public art and the Umbrella Sky Project is the mayor of the city of Coral Gables, Raul Valdez Fowley. Mayor, thanks so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity of addressing your audience.
So let's talk about that. First of all, where did this idea come from? Who came up with this?
The idea came up from the Coral Gables Foundation, which is a non-profit foundation we have in Coral Gables. And the director of the foundation saw this in Pensacola and came up with the idea that it would be a great, great project for Geralda. I saw it in Portugal 2 years ago in December. And frankly, it didn't occur to me to put it in Geralda, but the Coral Gables Foundation is the one that came up with the idea. They came to see me, and I ran with it. I thought it was the best thing that ever happened.
Now, I mean, at that point, they bring this idea to you. You've seen it before. Is that, do you have to go through a process in deciding when a project like this of this size goes up, or can you say, all right, let's do this?
No. I wish I could, but I can't. We have to bring it up to the city administration. You know, we have a city manager, former government, and then cost it out and see if it's feasible, you know, putting the structure up to hang the umbrellas from, and then the commission has to approve it.
All right. So I mentioned earlier that there was construction around this community and that was hurting businesses. The businesses needed some help. So, I mean, did you get any pushback at all, or was everybody on board with this?
I think when they realized what was happening, they were very much on board. The city, the street suffered, the restaurant suffered because it was very difficult to get there at one point. We had torn up the street, we closed traffic, laying down pipe under the street. It was difficult to get. In some cases, they had to go in through the kitchen. And we felt that they were asking for compensation, they were asking for lowering taxes. We said no, because that would benefit the property owner and not the business. But I think that this has, they're very, very happy with it. Their traffic has increased threefold. And as opposed to having 3,000, 4,000 people there every day in the weekend, now they're having 40-some, you know, 39,000 last Saturday, 41,000 last Sunday. It's a success. People know about Geralda, know about the restaurants, what's available there, and it's a success for Geralda and for Coral Gables.
Now, this won't last forever, though. It's not going to be up forever, right?
September 13th. So if you want to have a selfie, if you want to have your dog take a selfie, which I've seen people trying to get dogs to take pictures, go before September 13th, and it's worth it. It's a beautiful project.
So is there a concern that once it comes down, I mean, that's the attraction. People want to come to get those pictures. It's such a popular thing on Instagram right now. Once that comes down, the number of visitors is going to slow down, if not stop.
Well, it'll slow down, but they will have discovered the restaurants in Geralda, and hopefully they'll come back. And hopefully I'll have a brilliant idea one of these days or one of these years and replace it with something maybe for Christmas, Thanksgiving, Christmas. We have to keep the enthusiasm in Geralda, maybe a music show, maybe people singing in the street. I don't know. We have to come up with something, but this has been a success.
All right. So because we talk about this idea of public art and what it can do for a community, and as you said, the businesses were asking for something. They were asking for some kind of compensation to make up for the construction that was hurting them. But the cost for this, where does that come from, the cost for these umbrellas?
The cost for the umbrellas came from city funds. It came from city funds. We have art and public places funds, and it came from there. It was about $100,000. I thought it was $80,000, but it's about $100,000. And I think it was very much worth it. I mean, people have discovered Coral Gables. I heard somebody from another community saying that nobody went there anymore. Everybody was at Geralda looking at the umbrellas. And I think it's been very, very much worth it for the restaurants, for the residents of Coral Gables, fun. I mean, I see a lot of kids there, and it's been wonderful.
So when this is, as you said, you're looking for the next idea. You have to find something else that might be an attraction. You know, just like this was one of those things where you had a person who saw it in another city. Again, this is an international company. Is that the route that we should go when we're looking for public art projects, or, you know, should we be looking locally?
I would love to have a local artist or a local company come up with such a great idea. I think that we are not going to exclude wonderful projects such as this because they're Portuguese or because they're from everywhere. And we try to benefit local artists, of course. And we have an art committee that looks at projects. And we've had a lot of local artists exhibited in Coral Gables. Our museum exhibits local artists. But we're not going to exclude anybody or favor a project that may not be as meritorious because they are local. I mean, we look for local artists, but we want good projects.
Well, I'm talking with the mayor of the city of Coral Gables, Mayor Raul Valdez-Fali, about an art installation located at, and I've been saying Giralda, but it's Giralda. Giralda Plaza.
Either one. Okay. Is perfect. Yeah.
It's the Umbrella Sky Project. You've seen it probably on Facebook or Instagram. Lots of people are going out to see it. As the mayor said, thousands of people are going out daily, weekly, to get that picture with these umbrellas that seem to be just magically suspended over the street. When you first saw it, take us to that moment. You know, you've seen it before. You've heard about it. But then once it's installed in your city, you went out there. Tell me about what you saw.
I went there and saw it being installed, which is very, very difficult. But when it was finished, I was it was marvelous. I even took a selfie of myself with the umbrellas, and I think selfies are ridiculous. But I think it was marvelous. The color, the lightness, the happiness, it gives shadow to the street. I think it was wonderful.
If somebody hasn't seen it yet, how do you describe it? How do you describe it to people?
I don't know. I would describe it as an event that you have to see because it will fill your day with joy. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful project to see.
Have you gotten any comments from people in the community about, hey, why don't you bring something like that to our corner of the community?
No. We closed Giralda. Giralda is a restaurant street. It's smack in the middle of our downtown. This is not a project for a residential area. And we decided to close Giralda to car traffic because we wanted to make it something special. So I think in Miracle Mile, we've done a lot of work. And this has also attracted a lot of traffic to Miracle Mile, to the restaurants, et cetera.
It's not competing with Miracle Mile?
No, it's not. On the contrary, it's attracting traffic to Miracle Mile. And, you know, you have dinner in Miracle Mile and go to Giralda or the other way. And no, we haven't had any other businesses and whatever, they're different. This is a restaurant street, and it's wonderful.
Have the restaurants, have the businesses on Giralda, have they made up what they've lost? I mean, what have they told you about how this has helped them?
They tell me that they're thrilled, that they're having weekend traffic every day of the week, and they're packed from the time they open till late at night, and they're looking forward to the future.
Yeah, but and what is it that they're hoping for? What are they asking of you? Because they see this and they must be thinking, great, now do something else for us.
Well, we'll try to do something else for them, but they're very happy with what's happened because a lot of people have discovered the restaurants in Giralda and hopefully they'll come back.
Have you seen, because I want to get to this bigger picture to finish up here on the idea of public art and, you know, I mean, what the role of public art should be. I mean, is it something of pride for a community or is it something that needs to attract people to help the business?
I think it's everything. I think it cultural life of the community. We need art. I mean, we need a beautiful sculpture. We need parks as opposed to having a park, you know, a passive park, a park in the middle of a residential suite. I would like to put a sculpture or something or a I don't know, something in the middle of that in order to enhance the vision, in order to enhance our image, our status. You know, one of the best things that's happened in Miami-Dade County for a long time has been Art Basel. In the last 2 years, we've had Art Basel come to Coral Gables and because of our public art. And that puts us on a map, tourism map, business map. We're trying to attract business in competition with other municipalities around us. And I think that enhances our image, enhances our reputation.
Remind everybody, when does this installation go down?
September 13th.
So you still have
this weekend.
Yeah, you have a little over a month because after that, it is gone. And then you're just going to have to share somebody else's photo. Again, the mayor of the city of Coral Gables, Mayor Raul Valdez-Fali, joining us in studio. Really appreciate it, Mayor. Thank you so much for
Thank
your
time. Thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. And again, September, it's almost done. So if you're going to get that picture, then and the mayor doesn't even like selfies, but he took one. How about that? Well, that's the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again so much for listening. Have a wonderful rest of your Tuesday. We'll talk to you tomorrow.